Chapter 39. Gamay was almost relieved when the pair of husky guards came to take her away. She was bored to pieces, having concluded that the cell was escape-proof unless she could figure a way to blow the door off its hinges. She resolved to talk to someone at Numa about coming up with James Bond gadgets. But that would have to wait. Her only option now was to watch for a chance to run for it, once she was out of the cell. Her heart sank as the guards ushered her through a maze of corridors. She would become lost before she went 10 feet. They stopped in front of a pair of heavy bronze doors at least 8 feet high. The surface of the doors was cast with mythological scenes. The theme was heavy on skulls, but for variety there were giants and dwarfs, strange monsters, fierce horses, twisted trees, runes, and lightning around a central motif, a sleek, double-ended sailing ship. One guard pressed a button on the wall, and the doors swung in noiselessly. The other guard prodded her into the room with his gun.
"This isn't our idea," he said, in what sounded like an apology.
The doors clicked shut, and she looked around to get her bearings. "Charming," she murmured under her breath. She was in an enormous chamber bigger than a football field. She could trace its outline by the torches lining the walls of the cavernous space. In the center of the room, illuminated by 4 tall braziers, was a ship, its 1 square sail unfurled, that looked like the twin of the vessel carved on the doors. Before becoming a marine biologist, Gamay had been a nautical archaeologist, and she knew immediately that it was a Viking ship, or a very good replica of one. She wondered if she were in a museum. No, she decided, it was more like an elaborate crypt. Maybe the ship served as a sepulchre, as was the custom of the Norsemen. Partly out of curiosity, but mostly because there was no alternative, she began to walk toward the vessel. As she made her lonely way across the great hall, 2 pairs of red-rimmed eyes observed her progress from the shadows. The same eyes had hungrily watched her earlier on a TV monitor as she languished in her cell. The Krodzik twins had spent hours in front of the screen. They had taken in her every physical feature, from the distinctive dark red hair to the long, slim legs. There was nothing sexual in their voyeurism. That would have been too natural. Their interest was purely in inflicting pain. They were like a dog trained to balance a treat on its nose until the owner gives the okay to swallow. With Gamay enticingly within their reach, their sadistic urges surfaced. Gamay and the other woman had been promised to them. With Brynhild busy in the lab, they decided to claim their toy. They ordered Gamay brought to the great hall. The guards obeyed with some reluctance. The small army that protected Gogstad and occasionally projected its reach, as in Alaska, were all ex-military men, plucked from elite services around the world. In their ranks were former French legionnaires, U.S. Special Forces, SEALs, Red Army infantry, British paratroopers, and other assorted mercenaries. It was jokingly said in their barracks that a dishonorable discharge was a minimum requirement to work for Gogstad, and jail time was worth a bonus. They would shoot to kill on order, but they considered themselves professionals simply doing their job. The Krodziks were different. Everybody knew the stories of massacre and murder in Bosnia, and there were rumors of their special assignments for Gogstad. The men also knew of their close ties to Brynhild. When they were ordered to deliver the prisoner, they did so without argument. Gamay was halfway to the ship when she heard the unmistakable sound of motors starting up. The staccato snarl was made even more intense as it echoed off the hard stone walls. Single headlights appeared to the right and left of the ship and began to move slowly in her direction. Motorcycles. She could see the silhouettes of the riders. Gammy felt like a deer caught crossing a highway. Then the motors revved up to a high-pitched whine, and the motorcycles came at her like twin rockets. Her eyes went to the sharp-pointed lances resting on the handlebars. The riders came at her like grotesque caricatures of jousting knights. Just when it seemed the spears would penetrate her midsection, the motorcycles swerved off. They quickly reversed course and came in behind her. She whirled as they flashed by in a precision crisscross. They spun around, their motors idling, and once more the headlights faced her on either side like the glowing eyes of a huge, purring cat. The Krodziks were riding the Yamaha 250 dirt bikes that the security guards used to patrol the perimeter of the giant compound. The lances had been borrowed from the weapon collection decorating the Great Hall. The twins were not imaginative men, and their activities, whether the victim was a teenage girl or an elderly man, always followed the same formula: intimidate, terrorize, inflict pain, and kill. A voice came out from the darkness on the left.
"If you run fast," then from the right, "maybe we won't catch you."
Fat chance, Gamay thought. She could tell from the voices that she was dealing with the same metal-mouthed morons who had broken into her house. It was obvious to her they simply wanted a little challenge in their sport. She called out, "Let me see you." The only sound was the popping idle of the motors. The Krodziks were accustomed to having victims cower and beg for their lives. They didn't know how to deal with questions, especially from a defenseless woman. Curious, they edged their bikes closer and stopped a few yards away. "Who are you?" she said.
"We are Death," they said as one.
The short reprieve was over. The motors revved. The motorbikes reared up on their back wheels. The front wheels came down, and with a double shriek of burning rubber, the bikes shot forward, did another crisscross, then began to circle. They wanted Gamay to spin until she became dizzy and collapsed into a helpless, blubbering heap. She refused to play their game. Instead, she stood her ground with her eyes straight ahead, arms tight by her side. The wind created by their passes blew choking exhaust fumes in her face. It took every measure of self-control not to bolt for it. They'd be on her in a second and use their spears to cut her legs out from under her. When they saw she had no intention of running, they angled in. A spear tip came so close that it lacerated the front of her shirt. She sucked her stomach in. This wouldn't do. She began to walk. She moved deliberately with measured steps, so she wouldn't throw their timing off. Delighted at the new challenge, the riders took turns cutting in front of her, pulling their spears away at the last possible second. She kept on going, her ears filled with the whine of motors. She refused to break her stride. Gamay knew they could kill her any time they wanted to. She heard a bike coming in from the right. Taking a big chance, she stopped suddenly. The rider misjudged and went wide. The bike skidded around in a tight turn. But the move threw off the uncanny communication the riders seemed to have, and they wheeled around in confusion. She ran past the upturned bow of the boat, intending to vault onto the deck. But she encountered a barrier of overhanging round shields that protected the side above the oar ports. She saw why the Krodziks had let her get this close to the boat. They knew there was no way she could easily climb over the shields. The only access to the deck was a ramp near the stern. They probably hoped she would run for it. She made a motion in that direction, and they shot over to cut her off. She grabbed one of the shields off the side of the boat, then turned and held it in front, her back to the boat. The twins spun around and came at her with lances leveled. The heavy shield, made of thick wood braced with iron, was designed more for a brawny Norseman than a slim woman. Fortunately, Gamay was tall and athletic, and managed to get her left arm through the straps and hold the shield in front of her. Just in time. Tunk! The spears hit the front of the shield as one. The force drove her back against the side of the boat and knocked the wind from her lungs. The bikes peeled off to the left and the right, did quick turns, and headed back. Gamay put the shield down on the floor, braced her foot against it, and pulled out the spears. In contrast to the shield, they were surprisingly light, with thin wooden shafts and slender bronze tips. They were probably designed more for throwing than for jousting. She held the spears vertically and the shield at ready. With their weapons gone, she assumed the brothers were making a feint. But there was a blur of motion as a spiked ball whirled at the end of a chain slammed into the shield. Even with her legs braced, she was thrown back and went down on her right knee. She managed to keep the shield high in a move that saved her life as a punishing blow from the second rider crunched into the shield and splintered the outer layer of protective wood. The brothers had exchanged their spears for maces, the weapons developed to smash their way through armor. The bikes swooped down on her before she had the chance to stand. Again the spiked iron balls crashed into the shield. The wood protected her from the main shock, but disintegrated after the second blow until all that was left were the leather straps and useless framework. She grabbed for a spear and held it at an angle. The bikes held off their attack and went back and forth. Then one attacker came in. The spear spun in his direction like a compass needle. Gamay held her breath. At the last second, he turned away. The other came in from her left. She pivoted quickly to face him, only to be distracted by another attack on the right. It was a classic flanking tactic. They were not ready for a full press yet, probably just testing to see her reaction. One bike passed directly in front of her, its rider thinking he was safely beyond the reach of the spear. Instead of jabbing, Gamay brought the spear back on her shoulder and hurled it at the rider. He was moving fast. Her aim was too low. The spear hit the spokes of the front wheel. The force of the wheel shattered the shaft, but not before the skinny, knobbed tire turned at a sharp angle. The bike jackknifed, and the rider flew over the handlebars. The bike skidded along the floor, leaving a trail of red and white sparks. Gamay saw him hit the floor and lie still. The second motorcycle halted its attack, and the rider pointed his headlight at the still form. He dismounted, but he knew even before he crouched down beside the twisted body that his brother was dead. He had felt his brother's fear and pain as his neck snapped. Then came a moan that rose to an agonizing scream. A chill went up Gamay's spine as the remaining Kradzik brother began to howl like a wolf. She edged toward the rear of the boat, hoping that if she made it to the deck, she'd find another weapon. The brother saw her move. He straddled his bike in an instant. She held her spear out straight. As he came in from the side, she felt the spear jerk, then heard a clink of metal. He had chopped the spear tip neatly off with a short-handled battle axe. He stopped and held the axe high above his head with both hands. Then he came for her. She ran for the stern of the boat. He caught up in an instant and crashed his motorcycle into the back of her legs, knocking her down. Pain shot up from her knees and elbows as they smashed against the hard floor. But she had more to worry about. A figure was standing over her.
"My brother is dead,"
he spoke haltingly, as if he were waiting for a cadenced answer from his twin.
"You killed. Now I will kill you. I will start
with legs, one by one, then your arms.
With his black leather pants and sleeveless jacket, he looked like an executioner. His teeth gleamed as he grinned in anticipation. Gamay tried to roll out of the way, but he put his boot on her ankle and she cried out. As the axe came up, there was a whirring sound, and he grunted in surprise. His free hand reached up to feel the shaft of a crossbow bolt protruding from the side of his head. But he was already dead by then. The gleam disappeared from the red-rimmed eyes, and he keeled over. Gamay rolled out of the way as the falling axe clanked onto the floor. She heard quick footsteps, strong arms were picking her up, and she saw Zavala's familiar grin. Then Austin appeared. He was holding an old crossbow in his hands.
"Are you okay?" Austin asked.
"Nothing a good skin transplant won't cure."
She saw that Joe was carrying the gun he had borrowed from the guard.
"Not that I'm ungrateful, but why play William Tell when you had that thing?"
"This throws quite a spray of bullets," Zavala said. "It's great for cutting down a full assault, but not very good for a precision sniper shot. I would have backed Kurt up if he missed."
He knelt beside the dead twin.
"You were supposed to hit the apple on top of his head."
"Next time I'll aim higher," Austin said, tossing the crossbow aside.
She gave them each a peck on the cheek. "Nice to see you, even if I have to endure your dumb wisecracks."
Austin inspected the dead man near the motorcycle.
"It looks like you were doing pretty well on your own."
"I was about to go to pieces," Gamay said, wondering how she could joke about her near dismemberment.
"Where are we?"
"Lake Tahoe."
"Tahoe? How did you find me?"
"We'll explain after we pick up Francesca. Can you walk?"
"I'll crawl on my knees to get out of this dump."
"Nice outfits," she said, eyeing their white caps and suits. "Is that what got you past the guards at the door?"
"There weren't any guards."
"I guess they didn't want to be responsible for Daryl and Daryl."
"Truth is, we blundered in here. We saw you playing a losing game of tag with your friend. I grabbed a crossbow off the wall and watched as you set him up beautifully for a shot."
Austin took a pistol from one of the dead men.
"What say we saddle up before the posse comes?"
Gamay nodded and started to limp toward the doors, protectively flanked by the two men. The doors opened and Brynhild stepped in. She was alone, but that didn't make her any less imposing as she strode across the hall. She barely glanced at the dead bodies as she came over and stood before them, muscular legs spread wide apart like tree trunks, her hands on her hips.
"I take it this is your handiwork," she said.
Austin shrugged.
"Sorry about the mess."
"They were fools. If you hadn't killed them, I would have. They disobeyed my orders and defiled this sacred place."
"Still, I know how hard it is to get good help these days."
"Not as hard as you think. There's no shortage of people who like to kill."
"How did you get in here?"
"We walked in the front door. What is this place?"
"It's the heart and soul of my empire."
"You must be the elusive Brynhild Sigurd," Austin said.
"That's correct. And I know who you are, Mr. Austin, and your friend, Mr. Zavala. We've been watching you since you visited our facility in Mexico. It was thoughtful of you to honor us with your visit."
"Don't mention it. You must let us know who your interior decorator is. What do you think, Joe? Early Adams family or late Transylvanian?"
"I was thinking more like Munster modern. The boat-shaped coffee table is a nice touch."
"You will learn," the woman said. "That boat symbolizes the past, the present, and the glorious future."
Austin laughed. "An appropriate symbol. That boat isn't going anywhere, and neither is your empire."
"You Numa people are becoming tiresome." I was just telling Joe the same thing before you arrived. We don't want to wear out our welcome. If you'll excuse us, we'll be on our way. Saddle up, guys. Zavala, who was in the lead, tried to step around Brynhild. Out of habit, he flashed his trademark smile. Brynhild was a freak, he reasoned, but she was still a female. The famous Zavala charm was lost on the giantess. She reached out and grabbed him by the shirt, shook him like a terrier with a rat, then, with her great strength, threw him onto the floor. Zavala quickly regained his feet. Ever the gentleman when it came to women of any size or age, he smiled again.
I know how you feel, but this isn't a good way to end our relationship.
Brynhild replied with a backhand slap across his face. Joe staggered back a few steps and wiped the blood that was trickling from a corner of his mouth. Brynhild cocked her right fist for another blow. Austin moved in to protect Joe. He was watching Brynhild's hands, so when she lashed out her left leg in a classic kickboxing maneuver, he was caught by surprise. Her boot smashed into his chest. He felt ribs crack from the tremendous force even before he slammed against the floor with an impact that rattled his teeth. Seeing Austin fall removed all of Zavala's inhibitions against striking a woman.
That makes two sucker punches, he said softly.
Joe had financed his way through the New York Maritime College by boxing professionally as a middleweight. He won most of his fights, many by knockouts. He had gained weight since college, but still managed to keep down to a fighting trim of 175 pounds. He was 5'10", which gave Brynhild a height advantage of about a foot. She probably outweighed him by 50 pounds, none of it fat. Brynhild's kick had put her in a good position to unload a roundhouse right aimed at removing Zavala's head from his shoulders. Zavala's old ring instincts were coming back. He saw the punch coming and ducked as the right fist grazed the top of his head, and then he drove a left hard into Brynhild's midsection. The effort almost cost him a broken wrist, but it threw off his opponent's timing. She threw a long, loose left that caught air. Tucking his chin in and bringing his hands up, he tried a three-punch combo that had decked more than one opponent in his college days. He followed up a quick left jab with a short right cross and a left hook. The right missed, but the left hook caught Brynhild solidly in the jaw. Her eyes went glassy, but only for a second. She stepped back as he moved in and shot a hard overhand right to the heart that took his breath away. While he sucked in air, she got past his lowered guard and clouted him in the midsection. Zavala absorbed the blow with his hard stomach muscles and swung a right and a left aimed at her jaw. Both missed. Brynhild had been surprised by Joe's quick and skillful reaction. But now that she had his measure, she stood off and used her superior height and reach to pound him with the long artillery. Zavala guessed her strategy and tried to move in for an uppercut to her chin. But each time she lobbed haymakers at him while staying safely out of reach. His left eye was partially closed, and his nose was bleeding. He threw a long overhand left that caught Brynhild in the throat, but it cost him another stinging punch to the head in return. In spite of her size, she was as fast as any middleweight he had ever seen. The old ring aficionados used to say that a good big man can beat a good small man any day. Zavala hoped the same truism didn't apply to a big woman. He kept doggedly on, his timing completely off, throwing soggy punches that caught air. He'd only last another minute. Then she'd finish him off with a couple of neck-snapping kicks. Quite unexpectedly, Brynhild lowered her guard. Before Zavala's weary reflexes could take advantage, the giant woman collapsed in a heap. Joe stood there stupidly and wiped the sweat out of his eyes. He saw Gamay standing over Brynhild, holding one of the wooden shields from the ship in both hands. "There's more than one way to swat a Viking bitch," she said with fury in her eyes. Austin had managed to get to his feet. Holding his cracked ribs, he looked at the others and said, I hope we feel better than we look.
I'll feel a hell of a lot better when we are out of here, Zavala said through puffy lips.
Wait, Austin said, looking around. We need a diversion. Without hesitation, he went over to one of the braziers near the boat. He picked it up by the metal legs and dumped the burning coals onto the boat's deck. Then he went on board and tossed the shields into a pile. The flames from the impromptu bonfire flared up the mast and licked the bottom of the hide sail. Within seconds, the square sail was a sheet of fire. Black, noxious smoke from the blaze curled up to the roof and began to move horizontally along the ceiling. With his work done, Austin led the way to the doors. They waited off to the side as the chamber filled with smoke. Within minutes, the big doors swung open, and a group of shouting guards piled into the hall. The new supply of fresh air fueled the fire and sent the black clouds billowing throughout the great hall. The guards who ran directly to the boat never saw the three shadowy figures slip through the open portal.